First Timothy chapter 6, and the first two verses there, let all who are under the yoke of slavery regard their masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be defamed. And those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful to them on the ground that the masters are brothers, but rather they must serve them all the better, since those who benefit by their service are believers and beloved. Now these two opening verses of chapter 6 of 1 Timothy, dealing with the relationship between servants and masters, raise some difficulties for us Christians today. I want to divide this morning's message into three sections. Two problems, two paths, and two principles. First of all, the two problems. And the two problems are, first of all, the problem of the early church, and secondly, our problem today. Now, the early church's problem immediately becomes apparent, because as soon as the gospel of Jesus Christ moved out into the world, people began responding to the message of Jesus Christ. In the Roman Empire, the message of Christ really was glad tidings of great joy, because the Roman Empire was a world of despair and nihilism and hopelessness. The message of Christ was proclaimed, and men and women responded. Now the difficulty was this, that in his own lifetime, Jesus does not appear to have been conscious of class or of class barriers, as we are today. Nowadays, the churches are very largely middle-class institutions. We are respectable. We are safe. The churches are very largely filled with moral people who, by and large, live moral lives of rectitude. And on the whole, I would say that nowadays there is very little room in the churches for rowdies or antisocial elements or for people with major moral and psychological and emotional problems. These people nowadays are excluded from the churches because somehow the notorious and the undesirable are not wanted. We have become middle class and we have become respectable. But good old Jesus knocks the wind out of our sails, because he seems to have got along with all sorts of folks. He got along with the churchy religious people like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, even if he did have to tell them that they needed to be born again. And he got along with working chaps like Peter and Andrew and James and John. He got along with the Roman centurions, and he got along with prostitutes and swindlers and tax gatherers and the bon viveur who liked the good life and who threw parties for Jesus and thereby earned him a bad name, a friend of sinners, a wine bibber, and a friend of publicans, they called him. Jesus wasn't conscious of class divisions in the way in which we are. And so out the early Christians went with the great message, whosoever will may come. The circumstances of your life are completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether you are a free man or a slave. It doesn't matter whether you're a rich man or a poor man. You may be intelligent. You may be stupid. You may have a balanced personality, or you may be nervous and emotional. All these things are absolutely irrelevant. There is room for you in God's kingdom. Come and welcome to Jesus Christ. Whosoever will may come. And so men and women were converted to Christ. And the trouble was this, that some masters were converted to Christ, and some slaves were converted to Christ. Now that was the problem. Because in the home situation, in the domestic situation, masters and slaves had a very special relationship. The slave in a Roman household was simply a menial. He was a chattel. He was like a piece of furniture. He was a nobody. And he had absolutely no rights whatsoever. He was simply an object, a useful working object, like a piece of furniture. And the master had absolute rights over the slave. But in the Church of Christ, these men were brothers. And they would pray together as Christians, and they would sing together as Christians, they would gather round God's Word as Christians, and they would meet at the Lord's table together as Christians. It was a different relationship in the church from the relationship at home. And so the early church's problem was this. How were Christian slaves to behave at home in the presence of Christian masters? Were they to take from the church into the home that sort of meatiness and familiarity that you find in Christian fellowship? Was a slave going to say to his master, "Good morning, Brother Andrew," instead of, "Good morning, Your Reverence. Good morning, my Lord. Good morning, Your Worship." Was he going to say, "Good morning, Brother Peter"? How was a Christian slave to behave in the presence of a Christian master? And so that comes to life if you read verse 2. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that the masters are brethren. Rather, they must serve them all the better, since those who benefit by their service are believers and beloved. Now that was the early church's problem. And of course you find many references to that sort of thing in the New Testament. Lots about slaves and masters. Listen to these words from 1 Peter chapter 2. Servants, and it's slaves, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to the kind and gentle masters, but also to the tyrants, the overbearing ones. For a man is approved if, mindful of God, he endures pain while suffering unjustly. Slaves, be submissive to your masters. That sticks in the gullet nowadays, doesn't it? What about these verses from Ephesians chapter 6? Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart as to Christ. You must obey your master as if he was Christ, not in the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from your hearts. Now, our problem today is that many of these passages about slaves and masters are irrelevant to us. And we cannot go to these passages and take them directly out of the Bible and use them today for the simple reason that we don't have slavery. We have employers and employees, but we don't have masters and slaves. And because that situation doesn't exist, the rules for behavior do not apply. Now, these are the two problems. The early church's problem was, how were converted slaves to behave in the presence of converted masters? And our problem is that we cannot take these passages from the New Testament and apply them to the working situation today, because slavery no longer exists. Now, that leads me to the two paths, by which I mean two paths of labor. Now, generally speaking, there is only one system of labor in the world today. We have employers who offer work, and we have employees who offer themselves for work, and that's our system of labor. There are, of course, intermediate bodies such as trade unions to safeguard the wages and the working conditions of the employees. There are also societies for the safeguarding of the rights of the employers, and so on. But by and large, in a free enterprise society, work is offered by the employers and work is accepted by the employees under certain conditions. And as a matter of fact, that path of labor is a path that you find referred to in the Bible. Listen to these words, from as far back as the book of Leviticus, chapter 19. Listen to these words. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. It's chapter 19 and verse 13. The wages of a hired servant shall not remain with you all night. God is speaking to the employers. The wages of a hired servant you shall not remain with you all night until the morning. Meaning, the man has fulfilled his contract, he has worked for you, now you must pay him his wages. Now, that is a system of labor that we understand, because it's like the system of labor we have in the world today. Jesus acknowledges such a system in Matthew 10 and 10, the famous words, the laborer is worthy of his hire. He's not speaking about slaves. He's speaking about employers and employees. The laborer is worthy of his hire. And if ever there was a contemporary parable, it's the parable of the laborers in the marketplace in Matthew chapter 20. Let me read it. Oh, turn it up. Matthew 20. It's a parable about unemployment. Matthew 20 and verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning down to the marketplace to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now you see, he's not hiring slaves. It's our system of labor. employers and employees. Matthew chapter 20, verse 1. The kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning to hire laborers, not to buy slaves, for his vineyard. But there's unemployment, and so there are plenty of men. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw other unemployed laborers standing idle in the marketplace, selling their gifts and their time and their talents to the employer. It's our system of labor. And to them he said, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I will give you." And so they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing unemployed. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." They're not slaves, they're just ordinary workmen. "No one has hired us." He said to them, "You too go into the vineyard." Now, that situation is a recognizable situation to us, and was a path of labor in the old world. But running parallel to that path, there was the path of slavery. And actually, the word that's used for a slave in the New Testament is the word bond man, or as we would say nowadays, a bound man. And a bond man, or a bond slave, was bonded to his master. Sometimes, as a matter of fact, he was chained to his master. They say that that's the origin of the clerical collar, the dog collar. It's the iron collar that went round slaves' necks, and there was a chain on it. It was a sign that the man was a bond slave of whoever was at the other end of the chain. So I'm a bond slave of Jesus Christ. And very often slaves were marked by special marks, just as farmers mark their cattle or their sheep. You often saw a man in the Roman Empire with a nick out of his ear. It's a sign that he was somebody's slave, a sign that he was another man's possession. And sometimes slaves were carried home from the battlefields as trophies of war. If you captured a man, he was your property. You could do what you like with him. If you like, you could kill him. If you like, you could take him home to be the butler. But he was yours. In fact, the Greek word for master is a word you'll recognize. It's the word despotes. And it's the origin of the English word despot. And a despot was someone who had absolute control over the life of another man. There were two paths in that world. There was the path of labor that we understand, and there was the path of slavery. One of the difficulties is that you can't take the principles that govern the one path and apply them to the other, because they are completely different worlds. One of the really odd things about the New Testament is that it does not condemn slavery. It
Don't you think that's strange?
Nowadays, we think that slavery is moral wrong. But the New Testament does not have one verse condemning the moral wrongness of slavery. In fact, an American theologian, very fine Christian man he was, he wrote some good books, called Dabney, last century, said that slavery was Christian. That it was part of God's will. That sounds dreadful to us, doesn't it? Absolutely appalling. And yet there is not a word in the New Testament about the need for slaves to start revolutions and throw over the social order and bring in a new social order. Very strange. I wonder if the World Council of Churches has read the New Testament recently. Salvation, you see, in the World Council of Churches is political freedom. That's the new meaning of salvation. It's called liberation theology, if you've read any of the books. Some of the Christian bookstores are groaning with liberation theology books. Jesus is the liberator. Jesus comes to set you free. Jesus comes to start revolutions. Go to South America. The priests fighting guerrilla warfare up in the mountains. Well, they haven't read the New Testament because according to Jesus, violence is out. There is no counsel to the slaves to start a revolution. Jesus said, those who live by the sword shall perish by the sword. You can't bring in the kingdom of God by force. No more than you can bring in a perfect and a just social order by force. If you try to bring in a new social order by force, you simply finish up with a new tyranny. That's what Oliver Cromwell did. He got rid of the old tyranny, the tyranny of the Stuart kings, the monarchy. And he finished with the tyranny of the Commonwealth and the Roundheads. That's what's happened in Russia. They got rid of the tyranny of the Tsars, and they finished with the tyranny of proletarian communism with one-party government. You cannot bring in a just social order by violence and revolution. You simply institute a new system of tyranny. What the New Testament does is to sow the seeds of grace in the hearts of men. Seeds of grace which one day not only overturned slavery, but overturned the entire Roman Empire. Let me quote from John Murray's great book, The Principles of Conduct. Slavery in the age of the apostles had so penetrated society and was so intimately interwoven with it, and the materials of servile war were so abundant, that a religion preaching freedom to the slave would have shaken the social fabric to its foundation and would have armed against itself the whole power of the state. Paul did not then assail the institution of slavery. He satisfied himself with preaching principles which, however slowly, could not but work the destruction of slavery. What the New Testament does is to sow the seeds of grace in men's hearts, seeds which one day destroyed slavery. And lastly, two principles of permanent worth. The first principle is this: we are to work for Jesus. Whatever our work is, whether you are rich or poor, or bond or free, or clever or stupid, you are to do your daily work for Jesus. Not just for your employer, not just to earn money to keep you alive. You are actually to work for Jesus Christ, to please Him. And it doesn't matter how menial the job. You can wash dishes for the glory of Christ. You can scrub doorsteps for the glory of Christ. Do you know these great words by George Herbert? Teach me, my God and King, in all things Thee to see. And what I do in anything, to do it as for Thee. All may of Thee partake. Nothing can be so mean which with this tincture, for Thy sake, will not grow bright and clean. A servant with this clause makes drudgery divine. Who sweeps a room as for Thy laws makes that and the action fine. We are to work for Jesus. We are to work our daily work to please Him. And lastly, the New Testament says, we are to guard the name of God. Let all who are under the yoke of slavery regard their masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be defamed. And God's character, of course, means God's reputation. God's honor is at stake in the way we do our daily work. Let me speak personally. 75% of the work I do is with people who have absolutely no interest in Jesus Christ or the work of this congregation. 75% of my ministry is not seen by you. And I'll be quite frank with you. The modern parish ministry is just drudgery most of the time. If it weren't for your prayers and your love and your kindness and your tenderness towards me, I could not keep going in the parish ministry. It's just drudgery, running after people who have no interest in Jesus Christ and who do not intend to have an interest in Jesus Christ. But I'm doing it for Him. I go through the drudgery for Him. You can scrub a doorstep for the glory of Christ. You see, in our daily work, it is God's character that is at stake. It is God's reputation is at stake. And God's character is something that we should reflect in our daily work to a watching world. Let all who are under the yoke of slavery regard their masters as worthy of all honor. Two principles: work for Jesus, and secondly, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be defamed. Guard the name of God. May God give us grace so to do, and bless His word to us all.